I actually am speaking about a painful and difficult subject, and I know that it's been on people's minds. Because these days, I judge the potency of any issue by the number of emails I receive. If they're in the hundreds, it's a low-level issue. We have a very, very vocal and concerned community. And when the prisoner exchange took place in Israel, my inbox exploded. This is an issue, though, with a history. And we, as a people of history, ought not to be ignorant of what has happened throughout history with the Jewish people and how we have responded. First, some recent history. In 1970, two airliners were hijacked, two TWA planes going to Israel. On one of them was Rabbi Yitzhak Huttner, who was a renowned scholar, The Pachad Yitzchak is his standard work, and his students immediately mobilized and tried to figure out what they were permitted, according to Jewish law, to offer to ransom their rabbi, who obviously was eventually released with the other hostages. And because of that incident, there was a renewed interest in the long history of Jewish legal thinking about the subject of what you are permitted to do when someone has been taken captive. And over the past couple of weeks, I have spent a good deal of time looking into this literature, both because it is intrinsically interesting and reflects something about conflicting Jewish values, and of course, because it is so relevant to us today. In 2002, 6 years ago, Rabbi David Galinkin of the conservative Masorti Yeshiva in Jerusalem, the Schechter Institute, listed some prisoner exchanges of Israel and the Arabs in the years preceding 2002. In the Six-Day War, four Israelis were exchanged for 6,000 soldiers. In the Yom Kippur War, 294 Israelis were exchanged for 8,400 soldiers. In November of 1983, six Israelis were exchanged for 4,500 Lebanese and 99 terrorists who were in Israel itself. In May of 1985, three Israelis were exchanged for 1,150 terrorists. So as you can see, what happened recently has antecedents that go back in the modern state. Does it also go back in Jewish history? And the answer is yes. The Mishnah, compiled by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi in 200 CE, so we are talking about almost 2,000 years ago. Ein podin et hashvuyin yoter al kedei demehen mipnei tikkun haolam. You may not ransom a captive for more than their value, and there are various discussions about what their value means, market value. Mipnei tikkun haolam. Now, tikkun haolam is a phrase that you have heard, but the Mishnah is not talking about healing the bay. It's not talking about cleaning up litter or your carbon imprint. Tikkun olam means essentially for the good of the world, so that things will work the way they are supposed to. And the Talmud comes along and interprets this in two ways. It says you may not pay excessive ransom for a captive. One interpretation of tikkun olam is because it will bankrupt the family or the community that's paying for it. The second interpretation is because then you will encourage the taking of captives in the future. Now, why does that matter? That matters because if you accept the first interpretation, according to Rashi, That is, if you believe the reason you shouldn't ransom captives is it will break the bank, essentially, then the family would still be permitted to do it. Because after all, how you spend your own resources, not the community's, but your own, is up to you. And if your relative is taken captive and you want to spend every last penny you have to get them back, Jewish law would not tell you you can't do that. But if you want to spend the community's money, that you may not do. But if you accept the second interpretation, that is, the reason you can't spend excessive money is that you'll encourage the taking of more captives, then no one's allowed to do it. Not the family, not the community, nobody. Now that is part of what was Jewish law already a couple thousand years ago. But of course, such a difficult, controversial law doesn't stay static any more than it did today. And so the Talmud and later authorities go on to discuss what might constitute exceptions to this law, that you cannot pay excessive ransom for a captive. One braita, which is a section of the Talmud in Ketubot, says, if your wife is taken captive, a husband may pay up to 10 times what would be considered the normal ransom the first time she is taken captive. No. This is not talking about one of those cases where at the end of the, you know, of the CSI or the Law and Order, you discover that the husband was arranging for this captivity. It's talking about a real case. And actually, let me turn the laughter to sorrow. Think about a world in which you had to legislate not for what you will do when your wife is taken captive, but what you have to do when she's taken captive repeatedly. Think about that world for a minute. Where it is so common, because nobody makes a law for one instance, where it is so common that women are taken captive that you have to prescribe for the husband what he may do the first time, the second time, and the third time. And you realize that the anguish of the families in Israel who see their children taken captive, their husbands and their fathers taken captive, that anguish is not new in Jewish history. That we have seen this again and again. It is called by Maimonides a mitzvah rabbah, a great mitzvah, to ransom captives. And not only is it called a great mitzvah, but let me tell you a fascinating, astonishing, and wondrous thing. When they uncovered the riches of the Cairo Geniza, where all these documents were buried, not only did they find letters from Maimonides exhorting fellow Jews to redeem captives, but we found receipts given to the community for that purpose, signed by Maimonides himself. So in the Middle Ages, this was a major issue. And you can imagine that the knowledge that the Jewish community would ransom their captives led those who would otherwise perhaps not have taken Jews captive to do so. And yet, again and again, it proved too difficult for communities to resist saving Jews. And so in that Cairo Geniza, even though we know the normal ransom was 33 dinar, we see these receipts for 66 for 100 dinar, which is, in that time, an astronomical sum to redeem Jews who were taken captive. Rabbi Shlomo Luria, Poland, in the 16th century, testifies in his Yom Shel Shlomo that the Jews of Turkey in his day redeemed captives for far more than they were worth, according to market value, because, he said, the community decided to overlook the burden on the community. In other words, they couldn't stand the thought that Jews were in captivity. In modern times, rabbis have written on this subject extensively. When the Entebbe raid happened, before that, before the soldiers, with the loss, of course, of Yonatan Netanyahu, before the inhabitants of the plain were rescued, Avadya Yosef, one of the leading halachic authorities in the world, said that while the danger to captives is certain, the behavior of those who took them in the future is uncertain. So you're allowed to redeem them even far beyond what you would otherwise be permitted. And then, in the most famous and most quoted modern responsum, Rabbi Shlomo Gorin, who was the chief rabbi of Israel, gives every reason, and there are many, both in Jewish law and also what is called svara, that is, just reasoning, why you are not permitted to ransom captives, and then at the end, he permits it. And the reason he gives is what I really want to talk about this morning. He says that prisoners who are soldiers are, after all, agents of the state of Israel. They were given a mission, and therefore there is an implied contract between the state and the soldier. And the contract implies that if you are lost, we will seek to find you. Now, there are complicating questions here. Obviously, the implied contract is not only with the soldiers who are taken captive, but also with the soldiers that you send out to capture enemy soldiers. And how do they feel when you release the enemy soldiers that they risk their lives to capture? Also, there is the question, which sadly is a question in modern Israel, of the obligations to a living soldier as opposed to the obligations to the family of the remains of a soldier who has died. But I want to make 3 points about this question, which is far too difficult a question for people to be so strident and so certain. It is a question full of moral anguish. And the first is that the voluminous, and it is voluminous, the tremendous literature on this issue testifies to the moral sensitivity of our tradition and of our people. There never was a time when you look through all this literature when someone says, well, what can you do? They got themselves captured. Who cares? Nobody says that. No rabbi, no responsum, no modern commentator. There is a sense that every Jew, when taken immediately, becomes the responsibility of the community. And we may or may not be able to rescue them, but if we don't, that burden weighs on our conscience and on our hearts. The second is to remember the perils and the pain of our history. As we approach Tisha B'Av, there are glories and joys and wondrous things in Jewish history, but this is the time to remember how often rabbis had to give talks like this. How often rabbis had to say to their community, we need to raise money because so-and-so has been taken. Or a husband or a wife had to ask people who they knew to help them because their spouse or their child was in captivity. And the presumption of the tradition, by the way, is that any Jew who is taken captive will be mistreated. Nowhere does it say a Jew was taken into captivity and we assume they're okay. And that says something about the worlds through which we move and says something about the world in which we live. Because the third part of this is that never, never in history has the Jewish people been able to make the sort of deal that they make now. When you read through the response of one of the things that strikes you with powerful force is nowhere does it say, well, we'll give them some of theirs and they'll give us back ours. Because there was no Jewish army. There was no Jewish state. There were no wars in which a Jew could capture a soldier of an enemy because we didn't have that. You look in the medieval Haggadah and you want to see who is the Rasha, who is the wicked son. How is the wicked son dressed in the Haggadah of medieval times? As a soldier. Because the idea that a Jew could be a soldier for a Jewish state was inconceivable. So obviously if a Jew was a soldier, it was a bad thing. And he was a bad person. But all of a sudden in modern times, the calculation is not how much do we pay, but do we return their soldiers, their terrorists, their fighters to them so that we can get our boys home? And so even in the midst of this debate, when you read what our ancestors had to endure and the questions they had to ask, you say to yourself, God bless America and God bless Israel. As difficult as it is, we are not nearly so helpless as we were 500, 700, 1,000, 1,500 years ago when rabbis grappled with these questions. Now, those of you who are listening for an answer, ought we have done this, ought we not to have done this, have probably concluded by this point that you're not going to find it here. It was an agonizing decision, and I'm not sure it was a correct one, but I am sure that I am grateful I didn't have to make it. That I wasn't the one who had to face the families and say yes or no. But there is one thing I do know, and this we have to keep in mind. This Shabbat, we read the Parsha of Matot. And Matot talks about vows, about promises you make. And it strikes me that the promises that we make in our lives that are most important are the promises that we do not have to say. Not the vows we make that are explicit, but the vows that are implicit. You don't have to say to your child, don't worry, I will promise today that I'll always make sure that you have clothes on your back. It's implicit. You don't have to say to the people you love, I want you to know in times of trouble, I promise you I will stand next to you. That's what it means to say I love you. And the promises between the Jewish people, between the Jewish state and the Jewish people, they are implicit, unspoken promises, and all the more powerful for that. No one said explicitly to a soldier when he went out into the war zone, whatever happens to you, we promise we will get you back. But you know that when he went out, that was the promise he heard. Now, I understand that not every promise can be kept. And sometimes we make promises explicit and implicit in good faith that we discover in the end we cannot keep. But we ought not to deceive ourselves that we made the promise. Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebazeh, we are all responsible for one another. This morning in the Haftarah, there are those beautiful lines, Zacharti lach chesed ne'orayich, God says to Israel, I remember the goodness of your youth, how you followed me through the desert, through a land not sown. It is the implicit promise between God and Israel that we will never leave God alone and God will never leave us alone. And it is not only a promise with Klal Yisrael, with the people Israel, but with every individual Jew. Was it the right thing to do? I don't know. But did we promise to do it? Yes, we did. That's the promise that we make to the Jewish people, to each Jew. And even when the legal system, even when the Mishnah, which is as authoritative a law code as there is outside of the Bible, even when the Mishnah says, don't pay excessive ransoms, you're not allowed to do it, we see again and again through Jewish history that the promise overrode the law. Maybe the promise even overrode wisdom. So maybe it was unwise. But it was not un-Jewish. Maybe we ought not to have done it. But we certainly can understand why we did. The Mishnah was written in the wake of the destruction of the temple, when the Jewish people didn't know, they literally did not know whether they would survive, scattered to all the lands of the world. In our day, we have come home again. And one thing we did learn from our history is the only way we did survive was by taking care of each other. That we still have the powerful impulse to do that is a blessing. We pray for the bodies and the souls of every Jew who is captured by those who would destroy us. We promise explicitly and implicitly that we will do what we can to bring them home. And we have faith in God that sooner or later we will all be called home and all be blessed. Shabbat Shalom.